Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air. Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora! It's another week on Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And Maureen and I caught each other's eyes across a very crowded room at Tūranga last night where we went to see Niall Williams. Wasn't it great, Maureen?
It was. Niall Williams, the, hugely popular, wonderful Irish writer. Mm. Yeah, I think every last person in the room had read Niall and loved him. And he was such an eloquent and interesting, engaging speaker, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. It was charming and so many good stories and insights into the book. So, yeah, that was great. And we can expect more of the same.
We can.
May.
Yes, in May we've got three more Word Christchurches putting on three more events. The one I'm most looking forward to is, of course, American writer, First Nations writer Louise Erdrich. I've been a fan for more years than I care to admit to, and so she's going to be talking with Nick Lowe about her work.
I'm also really looking excited for that, booked for that, and I've booked for to listen to Rachel Kwong, or RF Kwong, actually.
Yes.
Yes. I think it's Rachel.
But, yes.
Anyway, and so fan of hers as well. So that's kind of gothic academia, but also Yellowface. So really, really cool author, and very excited to have her come. So, and then we've got the international AI expert.
We have.
So for everybody, for the nonfiction and business and everybody who wants to stay contemporary in the word, turning it on for us all round.
And of course, this week we have a jam-packed program, as usual. I had fun talking with journalist Sally Wenley, and I say fun advisedly because she's a remarkably courageous and bubbly person. But the book, of course, is very somber in parts because she became a paraplegic at 16. Mm. In a terrible bus crash with all her schoolmates. And it's an account of how she overcame her disabilities, how she became a journalist, but it's also, it provided her with the opportunity to go back and really question what went on.
Mm. And it's called Crash.
It's called The Crash. Yeah.
And has been getting wonderful attention.
Certainly has, yeah.
And so I am then talking with Catherine Lee, who is a terrific crime writer, Aotearoa crime writer, setting books based up in the north, and this is the second in a series that's called The Deep of the Dead, but Catherine's about to publish the next in that same series, so she was a lot of fun to talk to, and it really is terrific Aotearoa crime writing, of which we're seeing so much more.
We certainly are, and we're going to finish with Claudia from Scorpio telling us what events are coming up. And that's always fun as well.
So whoop, whoop.
We're mentioning the word fun a lot here.
That's right. That might be our theme.
It might be our theme.
For our murder and crash books.
Yes, exactly. It might show that we've got a strong streak of black comedy running through ourselves and the program. One-minute-16-year-old Sally Wenley was in a bus returning from a school picnic, singing, horsing around, chatting after a wonderful day. The next The bus was on its side at the bottom of a bank. Five people were dead. Sally was gravely injured and her life was irrevocably changed. The crash tells the story of what happened next and finally allows Sally to confront the reality of the accident and the ramifications of her injuries. Sally is an award-winning journalist who has worked in both television and in radio. She's a familiar voice on Radio New Zealand, one that always comes across as cheerful and straightforward. And that's the voice we hear in this story, Sally, really, until towards the end when you, as I say, go through what actually happened on that day. I'm always interested in how people structure memoirs. Where do you start?
Okay. Well, that's a really good question because I didn't have a beginning or an end. I hadn't actually planned it because I started off thinking, I want to jot down some of the fun, hilarious things I've done. And they ended up being chapters and sort of chapters or vignettes or short stories. And then I thought, actually, I want to investigate more about myself. And so I got my medical records and I got the coroner's report and it turned into something bigger. And being, as you know, being a radio journalist, I tend to make less out of more. In other words, sort of downsize it, keep my words simple, get to the point and then move on to the next topic. And this topic just started getting larger and larger. And I thought, gosh, this is quite interesting. It's, yeah, quite a learning experience for me. And maybe people could learn from what I'm writing as opposed to saying on air. Maybe it could turn into a book format because it goes through a bit of trauma, the stiff upper lip mentality. And I thought this shows how times have changed for the positive. And so then I started dotting in different, well, I was going to say paragraphs, but no, dotting in different chapters and working out, where shall I put the climax, I suppose. Mm. And for me, it just felt right to do it nearer the end. And I've been really flattered and chuffed with the responses because, apparently it flows well and the writing's not bad. So good old basic radio reporter does a bit of long form print.
Yeah, it seems to me the reviews have been more than positive. But Sally, take us back to who you were at 16. You loved boarding school. I didn't. But boarding school is a perfect place for somebody who loves sport and loves getting stuck into things. That was Sally, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I adored boarding school. I just had so much fun. And I think, well, a lot of that might come from, because I come from a small rural community. And in my primary school days at Moriah Kakaho Primary, there weren't enough boys to play in the cricket team. Because it was only a boys' grade as well. So I suddenly became Sid Wenley in the books and used to go off to cricket games around Hawke's Bay with our little country school. And I just loved sport and that camaraderie. And then that went on to boarding school when I was 12. I went to Woodford House and I spent my first term being so homesick and missing all my animals, my pony, my dog, the chickens, the pet sheep, you name it, that was there. But then I realised that this was a pretty cool environment, a lot of neat girls who were from different parts of the country, and I really got into my sport and just had so much, I just loved it. Just and I think that's maybe what made me quite good at it, is I genuinely just did it because I loved it. And that was hockey and cricket. I became the captain of the first 11 of both teams. And running, I adored athletics. And I used to get up in the morning. I'd even get some of the younger girls up when I was at school. After a few years, the younger girls who are homesick, and I'd say, come on, we're all going for a run before breakfast, and run around the Havelock Hills. And just that being out there in the early morning with the frost, you know, puffing away up the hills, and the steam coming out my mouth, and birds, and going across paddocks, and it was just my life. And it was just fun. And also it was fun being a bit naughty at school too. I did push the boundaries, did a few cheeky things. And for example, in the middle of the night, I sneaked out with some others, not just me, and we rang the big school bell. And how was I to know that it would evacuate the whole school? So, yeah, a wee bit cheeky, a bit naughty, and had an absolute blast.
Yeah, you were the typical sports captain of the school. But then waking up in Burwood Hospital, paralysed.
Yeah, but the last, because that day, every year at the beginning of the year, each house, there were four boarding houses, and they had girls ranging in age from about 11 to 17. And we'd go out on a house picnic, and each house had two buses. So we went out past Maraikakaho, where I'm from, out to Kereru, and had a wonderful day swimming and barbecuing and playing games and mixing with the whole house of girls. And then the last thing I remember is galloping onto the first bus down to the middle of the back seat, and we're all chugging away over the rural hills, and someone had a boom box going and music. And I mean, it does sound a bit fiction, but it was just, I just have vivid memory of lots of laughter and chatter and thinking, hey, I'm pretty cool in the middle of the back seat. And then nothing. And I don't remember the crash, absolutely nothing. And then, as you say, became conscious in, so I'm told, yeah, in intensive care in Christchurch before being transferred to the spinal unit, because they'd flown me down from the Hastings Hospital. So, yeah, I didn't suddenly become conscious, but it's all very blurry because I had, which I learnt through my investigation into myself, which turned into my memoir, I learnt that I'd had a couple of major brain bleeds. And, I've got a little hole in the side of my skull, and my spine had been smashed and my spinal cord severed. And so I had a bone transplant, I don't know if that's the right word, bone transfer from my hip onto my spine, and two metal rods, one rod put down each side of my spine. I'd say about the length of a pencil. They were there for about a year, and transferred to the spinal unit in Christchurch, and I spent 6 months there.
Meeting all sorts of interesting people, along with getting used to what your new reality was. But no counselling, no information about what your brain injury might, how it might affect you or how you might react?
I don't, because I have big blanks, but as far as I can recall, there was a social worker who sat beside my bed and asked me about my sex life, and I was a 16-year-old virgin, so it was like, what the heck? And that was about it. And Burwood was fantastic, you know, focusing on my rehabilitation for my spinal injury. So, yeah, as you say, that was a big focus. And, yeah, they had a gym, they had occupational therapists, physiotherapists, they had a pool, and everything that I needed as far as that front. And I even learnt how to drive a car with hand controls while I was there and got my driver's license when I was there. So there was all of that. But my, yeah, my recollection is there was no focus on the potential side effects of having a traumatic brain injury. But I also think back then people, specialists, everyone didn't know as much about ongoing potential issues from brain injuries. So I respect that. You know, people did the best they could with the knowledge they had.
Mm, indeed. The sort of person you were really had a huge amount to do with your rehabilitation, with your getting back into life, because you went hell for leather after that, really, didn't you? I mean, in that car in particular, belted it around the country roads, threw yourself into going to university, carrying on with some of the pursuits you could, like shooting and doing what you could.
Yeah, and I think because I was so competitive and through writing this memoir, I've come to the conclusion that actually after the bus crash, I was really competitive still and really angry. And I was actually competing against myself to do as much as I could, as well as I could. And as you say, I took up, well, I've been brought up on a farm. I'm very familiar with guns and shooting and pest control. And so I took up rifle shooting at Massey University with the able-bodied people. I think because I was so angry, I rejected every sort of disability-focused sport and thought, oh, I'm not like them. I was just mad, bad and ugly, really. And then rifle shooting at Massey, and then I got into the New Zealand rifle shooting team, and that was fun. Got to go to university tournaments, drink too much beer. Well, not when we were shooting. That was the fourth day. Yeah, and compete. And just it made me feel normal, because that used to be my normal. And being amongst like-minded peers, a lot who were from rural areas, you know, a lot from Canterbury, Hawke's Bay, and just being competitive and succeeding, and then came out with a Bachelor of Arts majoring in English, which was pretty cool, and then came down to broadcasting school in the wonderful Christchurch.
Yes, you probably came into these particular studios, because Plains FM is right next door to the broadcasting school. Yeah.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
We used to, to observe and then do a bit of work experience and a little bit of on-air stuff. So, yes, very familiar with that territory.
Becoming a journalist, it was an interesting transition, and I was fascinated that you were influenced by the great Terry McLean, because in my household he was, you know, somebody that was often referred to for some reason, I guess because he was, the great sports reporter. But you had a family connection.
I did. I felt really, really lucky. Yeah. I used to visit him in his rest home too prior to him passing away. Yeah, Sir Terry. He was a character ever since I can remember growing up as a kid, when he was coming down for a rugby tour or speaking about one of his books about rugby tours or a biography about a rugby player, an All Black. He'd come out to the farm, and he knew Mum from her days when she worked for, she was doing flight bookings, and then she worked for Qantas overseas. She worked in Auckland and Sydney and London. And so they kept in touch because she used to do all their bookings. And so he used to come out to the farm and chat to my brother and I. And then after the bus crash, I think I remember him coming to the farm for some book. And then, when I graduated from broadcasting school, I got this beautifully written letter from him telling me that he'd lost a bet with himself, because Sally Wenley was becoming an esteemed journalist, and he'd bet that this outgoing, courageous, outspoken girl would never become a journalist. And in this lovely letter was a cheque for $100, which was pretty big. And he used to write letters. Yeah. So I was very lucky. And I think he could see that I was always, I had a bit of a spark and I was interested in other people's stories and loved to listen. So, yeah, very, very fortunate.
Yes, the things that had happened to you and how you'd overcome them or learnt to live with them must really have, you know, added to your empathetic approach to people as a journalist, made people more willing to confide in you, to tell you things.
Maybe. I think I actually lacked a bit of empathy. I think I was a bit blunt. That's come over time. I mean, as you know, being a journalist and things, it takes a bit of time to develop that. But, yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I think because people, first of all, are surprised that here's this woman using a wheelchair, poking a microphone in their face. I ask a question and they just start talking. So maybe it was empathy. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I've heard some wonderful stories. And as I've got older, just appreciate that people share. And I've got better at listening. And when I'm doing my interviews, to work through actually with them and not ask so many questions and just have silences and let them keep talking.
It's a good thing to do, isn't it? Let it evolve sometimes rather than stick to your particular script.
Yeah. And as you know, it depends on the deadline. And whether it's like for a news bulletin, then I don't want them to talk too long. But then if it's for a feature, then I just stop so they keep talking for longer. So it's both. And I really like that it's a mix and a match. And also I've done a few features for the New Zealand Herald. So I've done a wee bit of long form. I did one feature about medical leeches that are, what would you say, grown, no, bred in Waikato. And so I went to the leech farm and, gosh, they lifted my wheelchair up into where all their leeches are in this water. And, oh, just so interesting. And then interviewed a specialist who uses them, like, on, for example, rugby players that have had their ears all, you know, bits and scrums and other medical things to reattach limbs. They put a leech that sucks on each side. So just suddenly become an instant expert on things by asking questions. And I just love that. And learning, always learning.
Sally, the outcome of this book, I mean, there's so much we haven't touched on, you know, the fact that things are so different now that if that accident happened, you would have, and the school would have been, you know, overwhelmed with counsellors and trauma people trying to help you through. But the outcome seems to me that people have, you know, come forth and wanted to connect with you now that you've told this story.
Yeah. I think it was the stiff upper lip back in the last century, and I understand it, and I'm not angry about that. But since doing my memoir, as you say, I have had so much of a response from so many people. For example, girls in our, I'd say, rival school, Iona, which is another boarding school just across the road, I've had messages from them saying they were not allowed to use the phones, they were told not to speak to other girls about it, and they just had to shut up. And this is a school, not even our school, so you can imagine what it was like at Woodford. And I've had very emotional girls, women, just crying and saying, oh, we weren't allowed to talk about it, and I never knew what to say to you. And I have had, I'd say, at least 50 messages, and I just feel so sad for all of them. A lot of them are still grieving and dealing with it.
Well, I think your memoir has done what you hoped it would, and possibly more, things that you probably never expected it to. So well done, Sally. I think you've told it in such an, as I say, straightforward but deeply thoughtful way. And I can just hope that many, many more people read it and learn from it. Thank you for your time. The book is called The Crash, a memoir by Sally Wenley, and it's published by Massey University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Catherine Lee is the successful crime fiction author behind 9 published books, including the hugely popular 3-book Elizabeth MacLean series, and now of a very successful Nairi Bradshaw series set in Northland, Aotearoa. The 3rd in the Bradshaw series, The Deeper, The Dead, was released last year, and readers are eagerly anticipating the publication of the 4th sometime soon in 2026. Catherine joins me in the studio for a Bookends chat this morning. Kia ora, Catherine. Thanks very much for joining us.
Kia ora. Lovely to be here.
Cool. So you began your writing career late in life, Catherine, but you do seem to be making up for lost time. But can you share with leaders how you came to writing as a second career?
I had a disabled child, my daughter. She was very disabled. And so I had her at home for a long while, caring for her and working part-time. And it's a very isolating situation. So I decided I needed something for me, not just caregiving. So I took myself off to a community class at a local college, and the teacher said to me, "Oh, you've got some talent." And of course that went straight to my head, and so I went off and I wrote my first book just in weeks. It was absolutely dreadful because I didn't know how to plot. I knew how to put words together, but I didn't know how to plot. And so I wrote a couple more books, just feeling my way through, just absolutely sure I was going to be the next big thing worldwide. and I would never let anybody even open those books now. But then I got a diagnosis for my daughter in 2013 that she had terminal liver disease. And I thought, you know what, I want to write something that's really close to home, something about the value of a disabled child. So I decided, somebody said to me, don't ever write a book based in New Zealand because nobody will ever read it. So I thought, well, the best thing to do by Elizabeth MacLean's, I had a friend in the States who happened to live in
Cleveland,
Ohio. And so I thought, I'll set it there, and that way I can get a little bit of inside information. So I wrote this story about the kidnapping of a 6-year-old Down syndrome child who happens to be the daughter of a Senate candidate, and what a minefield. Because initially I decided that I would start with the senator, the previous senator dying, and then he has to pick up the, you know, he has to be voted in. Doesn't happen like that. If a senator dies, the governor gets to choose the next senator. So it's not very good if a senator dies, because if your governor is, say, a Republican and you're a Democrat, they'll pick a Republican for the next senator.
Hang on, I've got to interrupt you here because I think this is a lovely segue into the next story or next question of mine, because I've seen you describe yourself as a pantser. And it sounds like this is a perfect example of what being a pantser means. Can you share with the listeners how what your writing process is then?
I think of a situation, and then I start writing. I do not plot. I have tried plotting, and having everything, but the instant I start, I already know the result, so I go straight there. And it's like, well, why didn't anybody else think of that? I can go straight there. So everybody, you know, that's exactly where my story's going to go. So it's better if I don't know. And with my first book in the Nairi Bradshaw series, The Water's Dead, I had to write the ending three times because I still didn't know who did it.
Amazing.
That's far more exciting for me as well. The book I'm working on at the moment is a little bit different. I can't tell you anything about that at the moment because I'm in the middle of major rewrite. But I know with, for example, The Deeper the Dead, I started with two people found dead on an island in the Bay of Islands. Now, I've kind of loosely based that island on Urapukapuka, which is a tourist destination, but it's a beautiful place. So, but this one is privately owned. And then I had to have my detectives come in and the crime scene squad come in and question the only other people who live on the island, but then also the people who knew that what turns out to be the owner of the island. And the person, the young man she's found dead with, is a total unknown. And I found that really exciting because as I could go, as I wrote, I could put in connections. And all the time, thinking about what these connections mean to the murder of these people.
I need to interrupt you, Catherine, because this is fascinating. Having just read The Deeper the Dead, which is this plot that you've kind of been describing, and I just have to reassure listeners that it all feels very carefully plotted in the reading. So the connections don't have a pantser feel about them, and the plot doesn't have a pantser feel about it. And I think that that's probably because I feel like you know your characters and your setting very well, Catherine. I feel like if you're going to have the style of being a pantser, knowing your characters well and knowing the place where you're putting them in this situation well gives you a real advantage, do you think?
What also gives me as an advantage is I'm a big picture thinker. If I go to learn something, I can't start with the minutiae. I've got to see the whole thing first. Now, that sounds as though it's completely opposite to the way I write. However, as I write, I never take notes, and I have the whole book that's happened so far in my mind. So I continue through with that layout as a base for where I'm going. And so I can, in my mind, I'll always go back and think, oh, now hang on, that can't have happened because at that point, this one was here and that one was there.
It's fascinating to hear you talk. I know I've seen about, you know, half apparently of writers have this pantser approach, although all the crime writers that I've spoken to have been very detailed plotters. And I wonder, you must now move and mingle with other crime writers, have quite a tight community with crime writers. Do you rib each other about the difference in your style? Do you get it come for a bit of grief about this pantser writing style from other crime writers?
No, I don't, because it works. And the simple fact is, I've written so many books that you feel in your bones where you are in the story, because the story's got to have an arc and you've got to know where you are in that arc. Now, inside that arc, and a lot of people did English and kind of eye-rolled at things like theme but you've got to have a theme, you've got to have your structure, you've got to have your, heroes and your villains. But then you can't have ultimate villains. You've got to have villains who are villains for a reason. They're not just always bad people. And what I love about writing about up here and about small towns is that when you come up with somebody has killed somebody else, I like to look at when this started. When did this actually begin? And who's been holding all these secrets, you know, all this time? And then something triggers something to bring it to a murder. And that's what I love investigating, is what's going on in the rest of the community and how are these secrets maintained?
So that brings me to just one more question that I had reading it. You have a lovely feel for dialect and dialogue in your writing. So, but writing cross-culturally involves quite a lot of sensitivity, particularly in a community like the Far North, or any community that's tight, I guess, but where there are cross-cultural currents and tensions. And so you capture a lot of that in the book, and you capture it really well in language and in dialect, which is nice. That, you know, as an Aotearoa citizen, somebody who knows the North, you can really feel that. But what relationships, advice, support help you feel really confident that you're on the right side of all those sensitivities when you're writing? How do you make sure that you're confident about what you're putting in the book from that perspective?
I have some people in the North here, and one of them is Mike Butler, who he's the chair of several Marae. I can send a piece to him and say, you know, how does this sound? Obviously, you've got to be sensitive up here anyway. I have a heck of a job thinking up names, character names, because I don't want to use anybody's names from up here. Mm. Because if they're a villain, I mean, for goodness sake, that'd be terrible. Mm. Or even just if they're not a villain, if they're just an ordinary character, they may resent my taking their name and using it in my books. But there's also various little quirks, because each district up here also has little quirks in their dialect. For example, when I talked to Mike, I said, you know, this character, excuse me, has said, oh, I'll go and get some money. I didn't have any money. And he said, no, they wouldn't say that. They'd say coin. They'd say, I've got to get some coin. So that's possibly specific to that area. But it just gives you a little bit more, I guess, flavour and texture in dialogue. I love writing dialogue. And I have been told I'm good at writing dialogue. I worked in the warehouse when I first moved to Northland, and that's where you hear a lot of the dialogue.
Sure.
And so that's really interesting, and I love listening to it. It's kind of poetic, various speech patterns. And so that's what I really enjoy.
Well, you certainly have captured it well. You also, coming to writing late, you also, you know, must have had, I mean, it's interesting, your story about the Elizabeth McLean and just kind of thinking, oh, I'll, you know, my senator will die, but that doesn't actually work. So, how did you, the police procedural stuff, though, all feels very legitimate, you know, and like quite carefully kind of calibrated to how things would actually be. But it must have taken you quite a bit of time to build up a picture of that.
Oh, absolutely. I've visited police stations. I tell you a funny story, which I will tell at the Writers' Festival, which is when I was writing my second book, The Deep of the Dead, and I had the Nairi knows who the culprit is, and she knows that this culprit is going making a beeline to head out of the country. So she has to head this person off at Whangarei Airport before they leave the country. So I have her race down in her car, leap out of her car, race into Whangarei Airport, and she's looking down all the gates and looking for this culprit and pushing people aside. And I said to my partner, hang a minute, I've never actually been to Whangarei Airport. Perhaps we should go. So we drove down. It's an hour's drive. And we drove down and we got there. It's one gate. And it's like one gate, and it's like arrivals, departures, but just one gate. The place was absolutely, but nobody around. So I had to do a quick turn on that. And so when I was down there, I thought I'd visit the police station too. Well, that's a whole story in itself.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. You are speaking at the upcoming Auckland Writers Festival.
That's right.
Yeah, so people will, listeners, you'll get a chance to hear more storytelling there from Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. We'll look forward to that next book release sometime very soon. Book 3 in the Nairi Bradshaw series is called The Deep of the Dead. It's published by Bateman Books. All the books are available online. The earlier ones might be harder to find in the stores, but they're all available online, and keep an eye out in bookstores for that upcoming release.
If you want to order them, they are available. So, yeah.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
This is a great time of the month for me because I always enjoy talking to Claudia Hertz-Jardine from Scorpio Books, our wonderful sponsors, because I love hearing what's coming up. Before we get on to what's coming up, how have this month's events gone?
Oh, they've been great, actually. Last week was fantastic. We had a huge launch on the Thursday night for Ariana Tikal, and it was beautiful. Lots of her family members spoke. Her partner, Ross Kalman, did this really lovely speech where he essentially said, "You're really great, you're so good at everything, and I'm actually a bit frustrated you became a writer as well," because I think the subtext was, you know, that's his thing too.
Yes,
right?
So you're encroaching on my territory. Yeah.
And she read some poems, and it was really nice to, I mean, I think of her as like, you know, I think of her as somebody who has this like massive long career in the arts, and naturally she's just a poet all that time too, but it's her first collection that's just all her, you know?
Yeah, well, I have just been talking to her, so we'll be playing the interview later this month, but, oh, it's a magic collection, isn't it?
Yeah. And like, I'm always a fan of a collection that's organised, you know, it's in two halves and speaks both of the words in the title. I'm quite excited to get my teeth stuck into it. I've just been waiting for a day off to do that. Oh, my God. This time of year, it's a bit hard. And then on the Friday night, it was kind of my fault, right, because I keep on booking these fantastic events.
I know you do.
We had this big harvest party, which was loads of fun. We had four authors speaking. Isabel McNeur / Isabel Taylor, as she writes, talking about Accidentally Wed to a Werewolf. And Kerry Donovan Brown talking about their sort of manuscript in progress, lots of dinosaur knowledge, which doesn't come up a lot at Scorpio, but I was very happy to have it spoken about at length in our shelves. And Angela and Nick from the Food Farm were fantastic. Got everyone quite riled up about food security and the fuel crisis. And Ray Shipley filling in for Isla Huia. And Ray read some poems from My Body is a Horror Film, their chapbook with Ngā Pukapuka Pika Pika. And then we just, you know, we had drinks, we had nibbles, everyone was there browsing the shelves, and it was just a really nice event. Yeah. It was
wow, fun. That's what bookshops are for.
Yeah.
Pull people in, make them feel at home, and then, funnily enough, they find themselves at the counter buying a huge pile of books.
Yeah, that's right. And they didn't necessarily know that they needed these.
No, they did not.
Talking about what's in them, and then they were sort of like, oh, you know. And we had a lot of requests to do it again, so we might try it again with the other seasons of the year. Yeah.
Great. Cool. Well, and we better find out what to look forward to. Of course, this month too, May coming up, you as one of the judges of the Mary Ann Peter Biggs Poetry Award for the Occams,
yes,
we're going to find out who you think, you and your fellow judges, is the best poet in the land for 2026, 25, 26?
Well, yeah, the judging year is for 2025, but yes. I guess the poet holds that title until this time, yeah, when the next round of books come through.
And you will be going up, I'm sure, for the...
Yes, I will be there. I'm looking forward to it. I've got a week in Auckland, so I'm going to go to some of the festival events too, which I'm very excited about. And we, you know, kudos to Auckland Writers Festival, another fantastic lineup of both... like New Zealand, Aotearoa and international authors, and we down in Scorpio Books are going to benefit from the AWF machine. We've got an author coming out to New Zealand who grew up here, but he now lives in England. But maybe I'll do the events in order and
yes.
I won't get it myself.
Yeah, sorry, I sort of felt I had to insert that there.
Thank you. No, that's great. I really enjoyed judging, but it was obviously very difficult too. So,
I know.
That's pretty much the easiest way to describe it, you know, without saying anything that I should. So, in Scorpio Books this month, May the 7th, Thursday night, we kick things off with the Scorpio Books Club. This month's book was Brawler by Lauren Groff, a fantastic short story collection. I rate it really highly. If you enjoyed Dead Ends by Laura Borrowdale last year from here in Ōtautahi, or if you enjoyed Lauren Groff's previous novels or short story collections, you'll find something to like here. It's all very, you know, bruised and bloody and gritty. All of the stories have a real dark core, and I think it was quite a stroke of mastery to call it Brawler, because it feels like all the main characters in the stories are really like in the grips of something, you know. There's this sort of intensity and sort of like latent human strength going on. And I just thought it was a fantastic book. I ripped through it. It was awesome. So, yes, if you want to talk about it, if you read it and you want to talk about it, please come along to Books Club on Thursday the 7th of May. It will cost you $10, but you get a discount on anything you buy, and there's some drinks and nibbles involved. And then we have a little quiet period because I'm busy up in Auckland and there's a few things going on. And on Tuesday the 19th of May, we will be hosting the Ōtautahi launch of Have This Heart by Lawrence Patchett. Many of you who come to events will have seen Lawrence. Lawrence is a regular. And Lawrence is releasing another short story collection. So short stories are having a bit of a time this year. And the copy about this book is that this is all about men trying their best, maybe trying not their best, to make an impact and to make a difference and to help people out. I'm quite interested by this collection. It's not my turn with the reading copy yet. I'm waiting patiently in line. I'm excited to see what Lawrence has done with this premise, and I think we're going to have a grand old time. So please join us on Tuesday the 19th of May. And then, as I mentioned, later that week, on a Sunday night, just a note for anyone out there listening, so we don't usually do events on Sundays, but we've made an exception for this author, and it's going to be a 4:30 p.m. start, so slightly earlier, we're going to have Christopher de Hemel in the shop. Now, Christopher has written a memoir called The Migrants, which is about his career as an expert in manuscripts, illuminated manuscripts to be specific. So Christopher grew up here in New Zealand, and he has quite fond memories of that time. And then he moved away to England to become a Cambridge scholar. And he has written he's written many books, actually, we've sold them throughout the years. They're pretty much all about illuminated manuscripts and, you know, what's that word for sort of literary criticism, but about the sort of medieval period rather than contemporary literary criticism. And also, you know, the making of books, not necessarily the text in them, but the whole package, you know.
There's a great article about him in The Listener, one of the recent listeners. And there's an anecdote in there that he tells of the great A.W. Reed from the publishing house ripping a page out of a book. These illustrated manuscripts, ripping a page out and giving it to Christopher when he was quite young, 12 or 13, because he began this interest in, you know, as a very young boy.
Hmm.
And he still has that page of the manuscript, and apparently he's going to give it back to wherever the book is, somewhere in a library or archives here.
Mm.
Sorry, so, you know.
No, that's all right.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I'm going to find that article. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is the thing, right? Like, so we've been stocking his books for years, but they're quite niche topics. So we've sold them in their handfuls. But this, I think, is the first time where he's released a book that's going to touch on, you know, his roots out here. So there's been quite a lot of interest about it because obviously when scholars kind of go big from New Zealand, we're all kind of like, oh, you know, because if you do want to really get into a field like that, unfortunately, you do have to leave New Zealand, you know, just speaking from my own experience in the classics, you know, you've really got to go to Oxford or Cambridge, jump the gap. So we're really looking forward to having Christopher in the shop. He's going to talk about the migrants, and we'll have some drinks and nibbles. And I think it's going to be lots of fun. Yeah. Whether or not you really enjoy an illuminated manuscript.
No, but he sounds like as you say, a fascinating person, and his whole, the trajectory of his career is quite extraordinary. So whether or not, as you say, you're a medievalist,
come check it out. Yeah. And my final event to talk about for this month is the 50th birthday of Scorpio Books.
Huge
events are sort of invitations are trickling out, and we are about to get ourselves organized and start promoting it a little bit more widely, but we think it's going to be quite a big one. So make sure you get your RSVP in pretty quick, because it's going to be a big party, and we're going to need to know how much food to make and how big the cake's going to be. But basically what you can expect, I don't know if you came to our pre-annual sale party last year. We decided to try this thing in 2025 where the night before the annual sale, which always happens around King's birthday weekend, we had a kind of preview party, and we had drinks and nibbles. We did some giveaways. We got people a bit excited about the sale stock for the year. We're going to do that again, but we're also going to add the birthday celebration. So there's going to be a timeline of the shop over the 50 years. Myself and some of the other staff have been trawling the archives, finding old printed material about the shop, some fantastic old advertising collateral and interviews and photos and things like that. Unfortunately, we did lose a lot of it in the quakes when the building was cut off and behind the cordon at 79 Hereford Street. But we have been able to find a fair amount of material, and Dave does remember a lot. So It's a celebration of Dave and his 50 years at the helm of the business known as Scorpio Books. And it's going to be heaps of fun, so please come and join us. And there's going to be lots of goodies. There might even be some flash tattoo going on.
Crikey!
Yeah.
Well, I have to say that I remember going to the first iteration, which wasn't called Scorpio, out near the university. So, and I've been in Otatahi since 1972, and so I would have. Yep, I can't tell you what the year that was, but my husband and I were absolute regulars at Scorpio when they moved to town in there. They're in their sort of about their fourth place, aren't they, really?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, the earthquakes tossed them out of Hereford Street. They were in, they had and they had something in the box in that place where all the container was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, celebration, absolutely. And Dave deserves all the accolades that he gets. I will certainly be there. Claudia, it's going to be a fantastic month, and I'm intrigued to hear who the best poet is. And I hope you have a wonderful time in Auckland, savouring all the events and writers and all the interactions you have with all the people up there. And thank you for doing such a magnificent job at Scorpio, putting on all these events.
It's a pleasure, to be honest. Square peg in a square hole. It's going to be great.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.